Hello and welcome back to another Pisky Bite, shorter episodes where we explore some of the folklore, history and legends from across Devon and Cornwall. I hope you're all keeping well. I had planned to try and get this episode out a little earlier, but as is often the case, other work and things got in the way, and particularly with this episode, it took a bit of time delving into the records for the research. Before we get started, just to say a big thank you to all of you who've been listening and supporting this series so far. If you're enjoying it, then please don't forget to give us a like and subscribe. That really helps me to grow this project and to get the word out there. Perhaps consider leaving a review. You can also get in touch by emailing me at thepiskytrap@gmail.com. If you can, and you'd like to support the series further, allowing me to keep researching and keep this project going, then please check out my Patreon page at patreon.com/thepiskytrap. Okay then, let's crack straight on with it. In this episode, I wanted to take a little look at some examples of superstitions, beliefs and customs surrounding witchcraft in Cornwall. Now, I know that the term witchcraft is a tricky one, and there's countless books and papers that have been written on the subject. There's even some brilliant books out there focusing on Cornwall as well. What I wanted to do is to look at some examples that highlight belief in folk magic, charms, and witchcraft, specifically the concept of what's known as ill wishing or evil wishing, and where possible, to look in a bit more detail at the individuals involved. I came across quite a number of references, cases from all over the county, a lot of them from the 19th century and some from the early part of the 20th century as well. But there were so many, and I was thinking, how do I whittle this down? And then I came across a couple of things in relation to the area where I live, the area where I grew up, in mid-Cornwall. So, before I prattle on any further, we're going to be taking a look at some local stories surrounding witches and the idea of ill wishing from mid-Cornwall. Kelvin Jones, who's written a number of books exploring Cornish witchcraft, writes, "Those who practiced witchcraft in the early to late 19th century were divided into different categories according to the special knowledge or skills they possessed. There were white witches, black witches, pellers, charmers, and healers." Jones goes on to quote the Reverend Hawker of Morwenstow, who once wrote, "I do not exaggerate when I affirm, at all events my own persuasion, that 2/3 of the total inhabitants of the Tamar side implicitly believe in the power of the malocchio, as the Italians name it, or the evil eye." This mention of the evil eye ties into this idea that there was still a strong belief that you could be ill-wished by someone who's essentially put a spell, if you like, on you or your family, or even your livestock, perhaps, to bring about your misfortune. Jones goes on to provide an example from an article in The Cornishman in 1883 that reported, "Superstitions die hard. A horse died the other day on a farm in the neighbourhood of St Ives. Its carcass was dragged on a Sunday away up the granite rock basins and weather-worn bosses of Tregobbin Hill, and there burnt, in order to drive away the evil spell or ill wishing which afflicted the farm where the animal belonged." So we have this idea that as relatively recently as the 19th century, and certainly into the first half of the 20th century, there was still a fairly widespread belief in spells, charms, and certain superstitions that quite often fall under the category of witchcraft. But often in the sources, these people are described as being a wise person or a peller or a charmer. Let's take a look now at a few examples from Mid-Cornwall. And I should say at the outset that some of the articles and accounts use language and terminology that's very much, well, it's of its time, shall we say. The North Devon Journal, dated the 22nd of January 1880, had an article entitled "Death of a Reputed Cornish Witch." An extraordinary but well-authenticated instance of belief in witchcraft comes from St. Blasey, Cornwall. A woman named Keem, who died the other day, was believed by her neighbours to be a witch, and great difficulty was experienced in getting anyone to bear her to her last resting place. It was feared, in fact, that the funeral would have to be postponed. But at the last moment, several bricklayers, who happened to be at work in the neighbourhood, were induced to lay down their tools and carry the coffin to the church in their shirt sleeves. After the service, a like difficulty was experienced in getting the coffin to the grave, and that duty had, at length, to be done in a very irregular way. The decease of the witch, it is said, has apparently lifted a weight from the minds of many weak persons, one cripple asserting that he shall now recover, and should never have been a cripple had she not ill-wished him. This is a fascinating little record that I actually encountered when I was doing some research on something else, but I had to look into it a bit further. I managed to find a burial record for the 2nd of January 1880 for a Catherine Keem, who was aged 59. Now, the record is quite hard to read in full, but some of it says, "A reputed witch. Bearers could not be had. Bricklayers in their shirt sleeves came to," and then it reads something like either "our help" or "our service." The last bit's quite difficult to read. In the 1871 census, there's a Catherine Keem, who it appears was born in St. Mewin, so not far from St. Austell, in around 1821. At the time, she's listed as 50, a widow, and recorded as an annuitant, that is, someone who's basically receiving a payout or a pension, perhaps. At present, unfortunately, I haven't been able to find out much more about Catherine, but I aim to keep researching. As a final note, there is a mention in the Royal Cornwall Gazette dated the 30th of January 1880 that reads, "I am happy to record that several of the most respectable tradesmen of the town have expressed their cheerful readiness to bear to their last resting place the remains of any poor person who, from whatever cause, may have become obnoxious to the stupid and superstitious notions of the ignorant. Such a scene as that of the funeral of the poor woman Keem, the reputed witch, is not likely to occur again." Our next account comes from Roscola, which is up in Clay Country. It's sort of between Luxillian, Trethergy and Bugle. And I found an article in the Shields Daily News, dated the 28th of January 1895, entitled "Superstitions in Cornwall, a White Witch." A girl residing in Roscola, Cornwall, the daughter of poor parents, was seized with fits, epileptic I should imagine, but no one can speak with any certainty about this because no doctor was called in. A white witch in the neighbourhood, however, was consulted. She shook her head and said the case was serious, and in all probability the girl had been bewitched by somebody. They had better take her away to try to discover who it was and bring her back in a week. Before the week was up, the witch's intelligent suggestion had produced its effect. The girl began to dream every night of a stout elderly woman with a very red face who approached her in a threatening manner, and the parents hurried off to report this new and alarming symptom to the witch. Of course, the witch was triumphant. There could not be a doubt that the red-faced elderly lady of the girl's dream had wrought the mischief. It only remained to identify her. Did the parents know anybody who answered to the girl's description? Now, there lived at no great distance from the girl's cottage an old lady, charitable popular and highly respected, but stout and having an unfortunately red face. No one had ever suspected her of any but kind and benevolent actions, but this fact, the witch argued, really made the case against her stronger, since it was well known that all persons who practiced magic were extremely apt at diverting attention from themselves. It is human to err occasionally, so that when you find anyone who appears not to err at all, you will do well to expect some agency which is not human. Besides, if the old lady had not bewitched the girl, what was she doing in her dreams? There was no resisting these arguments. They would have been ample 150 years ago to set the poor old lady swimming in the river, which, of course, would have been much the best way of breaking the spell. As that, unhappily, was impossible, the next best way was to go by night to the old lady's house, take a stone from her garden wall, and put it into the kitchen fire at the girl's house. When it was charred away, the fits would cease, and indeed they would cease earlier still if the cure could be helped by hanging round the girl's neck the finger of a man who had hanged himself. But such things were hard to come by. Fortune favoured the girl. A man hanged himself that very week in a hamlet near at hand. The suicide's finger was secured, used as the witch had directed, and the fits ceased almost immediately. This case occurred in the year 1887. Another fascinating story, and an intriguing insight into the beliefs surrounding ill-wishing or being bewitched, if you like. As well as some of the charms and superstitions around countering it, it's a strange one as well in terms of the way it's written, in that the writer does come across as a bit sarcastic at times. There's a slight mocking tone, highlighting these rural superstitions, but not to the extent that some other writers around that time do. Now, we mentioned the town of St. Blasey earlier, which is in mid-Cornwall on the south coast. Well, close by, about a mile or so to the east, is the village of Tower Dreth. And a couple of miles further along again is the village of Gallant, which are both the subjects of our next accounts. In Robert Hunt's Popular Romances of the West of England, written back in the 1860s, there's a section on witchcraft superstitions and charms, and he talks of an acquaintance at Tower Dreth and his experiences. And I should say that some of the names have been obscured to keep them anonymous. He says, "My correspondent writes, I was also present at a magistrate's meeting at the Porcupine Inn near Tower Dreth some years ago, when an old woman from Gallant was brought up for witchcraft. One farmer, who appeared against her, stated that he had 6 bullocks hanging up in chains in his orchard, and he attributed their disease and death to the poor old woman's influence. The case was dismissed, but it afforded a good deal of merriment. There was a dinner at the inn after the meeting, and some of the farmers present were disposed to ridicule the idea of witchcraft. I said, well knowing their real views and opinions, 'Gentlemen, it is all well enough to laugh, but it appears to me to be a serious matter.' Upon which Mr. Blank, a farmer of Blank, said, 'You are right, Mr. Blank. I'll tell of 2 cases in which one family suffered severely.' And he gave us the details of the cases. All the others present had a case or two, each one with his own experience to vouch for, and the whole afternoon was spent telling witch stories. So I recently found out that this place mentioned, the Porcupine Inn, seems to have been on Tower Dreth Highway. It apparently served the workers at the Foy Consols mine nearby, and there were petty sessions held there on the 3rd Monday in each month. Staying in the Tower Dreth area, there's an article in the Cornish Guardian from 1960 entitled "The Horrors of Witchcraft," where they're talking in reference to a chap called George Rundle Prynne back in the 19th century, and they write, In an unfinished autobiography, Prynne writes of the belief in Tawadreth Parish, 120 years ago, in witchcraft and the power of the evil eye, and states that ill-wishing was very prevalent. This intrigued me, so I had to look into it a bit further. And through something called Project Canterbury, I found a paper entitled George Rundle Prynne, An Early Chapter in the History of Catholic Revival by A. Clifton Kelway. In this paper, we learn that Prynne, or Preen perhaps, I've opted for now to pronounce it Prynne, so apologies if I've got that wrong, who was born at Lou in 1818. It seems that he took holy orders, and from sometime in 1841, he was situated at Tawadreth. There's a particular section of his writings that are relevant to what we're talking about, and it reads as follows. They, the people of Tawadreth, were certainly superstitious and strong believers in witchcraft and the powers of the evil eye, and evil wishing was very prevalent among them. Some striking incidents strongly illustrating this made a lifelong impression on me. There was an old woman living with an imbecile son in a hut by the roadside near the village of Gallant, who was commonly reputed and believed to be a witch. There was a good deal of excitement and talk about her and her doings in the neighbourhood, and her hut was said to be quite unfit for human habitation. My vicar, who was a local magistrate, accompanied by some others, went to see if this report was correct, and found it was but too true, and the poor old woman was removed to clean, tidy rooms in the village of Gallant. I went to visit this reputed witch in her new abode and found a decrepit old woman, very helpless and off her head and not over happy in her new quarters. The peculiarity of her previous abode, the unaccountable way in which she managed to pick up her living, were, I think, the only grounds which first fixed suspicion upon her. And then, when people called after her and persecuted her, I have no doubt that in her half-crazed anger she uttered a good many evil wishes and very excited words against her tormentors. I find this really interesting in that you do get a sense of compassion here for an elderly woman who's become isolated from the community, and Prynne speculating that the way in which she's living on the fringes of Gallant and the circumstances in which she's living has resulted in suspicion and superstition falling upon her. Now, I have to wonder if this supposed witch in Gallant may be the same person who was called up to the petty sessions at the Porcupine Inn because of this alleged ill-wishing of the cattle. It's just a theory, but it seems possible, as Gallant's, well, it's quite a small place. Prynne then continues straight on from that to talk in detail about another case. He says, "But the excitement caused by the supposed witchery of this old woman was as nothing compared to what was soon afterwards raised in the village of Tawadreth itself. One day, a young man was brought home from the mine on a stretcher, dead. He had been killed by an accident. Not a very rare occurrence amongst miners, but on this occasion, the villagers were in a high state of excitement. They declared that the young man had been evil-wished by a witch called Jenny Broad, living in the village, who they averred had had words with him that very morning and had wished he might be brought home dead. I knew Jenny Broad well. I had chatted with her by her fireside, and she evidently liked my visits, for no other reason that I know of except that I suppose I conversed with her naturally. She was about 50 years of age, a woman of strong character and strong feelings, and of intellectual capacity certainly above the average of her neighbours. I cannot think how it was that the suspicion of being a witch was fixed on her. As she had neither a hooked nose nor a humped back, but was a clean, well-grown and respectable-looking woman. I did my best to allay the storm that raged against her, but in vain. A fresh incident occurred that added fuel to the excitement. A miner was suddenly taken ill. and as the cause of his illness was not known, poor Jenny was accused of having laid a spell upon him and his family, and the neighbours said he could not recover until the spell was removed. The only question was how this difficult job was to be effected. The sapient decision arrived at by the experts was that this could only be done by a white wizard. It was ascertained that there was one living at Mevagissey, and he was promptly sent for. His arrival caused a great sensation. I was visiting the sick man as a matter of duty, and found the white wizard in the room. He was a small, wizened-looking old man, and as I regarded him as a miserable impostor, our interview was not of an amicable character. Of course, I did my best to persuade the sick man and his family of their sin and folly, but I fear I was not very successful in shaking their belief in witchcraft and its proper antidote. The excitement was so great as to put the village in a regular uproar. A special meeting of magistrates was called, and the white wizard was taken into custody and brought before them. The largest room in the principal village inn was crammed with an excited crowd. I was present, and I only regret that I did not take notes of one of the most extraordinary examinations I ever attended. The upshot was that the white wizard was bound over to keep the peace and was ordered out of the village. Several persons were examined in connection with the matter, but on what grounds I do not remember. One thing, however, was elicited from one of the persons examined which could not fail to stamp itself sharply upon my memory. It was the receipt for becoming a black witch. The process related was so shockingly wicked, involving such a terrible profanation of the Blessed Sacrament, that I shrink from recording it. Certainly, if anything could utterly harden the heart, kill conscience, and transfer the will to the keeping of Satan, it would be difficult to imagine any process more likely to affect these objects. Well, what to say about that? It's quite a detailed account, which, so far in my research, is quite rare. You get a real sense, from Prynne's perspective, that there was still a fair amount of belief and superstition surrounding this concept of ill-wishing and witchcraft. The bringing in of this white wizard from Mevagissey and the meeting of the magistrates to investigate this, and ultimately the decision that the guy should leave the village, does that reflect a change in attitudes, especially from the ones with influence, the ones making the decisions? Or was it simply, this was going to cause way too much trouble, too much fuss and debate, it's best if he just leaves? You also have to wonder how much influence Prynne himself had as well. I tried to find out a bit more about Jenny Broad, and I have found a record in the 1871 census of a Jennifer Broad, who was then living in Gallant. Her age then is given as 77, which would have made her around 47 at the time Prynne was writing about. It says that she's a widow, and she appears to be living with a family by the name of Meager. It tells us that she was born in Llanlivery in 1794 or thereabouts. Going back a bit further, I've found a marriage record, again at Gallant, on the 26th of June, 1826, for a Jennifer Ruse, or Roos, who married a John Broad. Now, what's interesting is that on the same day, a William Broad married a woman by the name of Mary Meager. So, assuming that William may well have been John's brother, Mary is then Jenny's sister-in-law. It might well explain why Jenny is living with the Meagers in later life. I'm afraid that's all I have so far, but again, I aim to keep researching. So if I find out any more about Jenny Broad or about Catherine Keem, I will keep you updated. If you're a local historian, a researcher, or a folklorist, and you've found out things relating to these stories that I haven't discovered yet, then please feel free to drop me an email and get in touch. It'd be great to hear from you. In the meantime, that's it for this episode. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you found it interesting. We will be coming back to this subject, looking at other cases surrounding witches, pellers, charmers from other places around Cornwall in the future. But for now, thanks for listening. We'll be back again very soon.